Welcome to Talk Tennis. I'm your host, Michelle. Join me on this episode as we chat and obsess over all things tennis. From deep dives to industry experts, pro players, coaching perspectives, and the playtest squad, you are sure to have some fun with us. But beware, laughter and mispronounced names are sure to be expected in the following episode. So grab your favorite sweatbands and get ready for some off-court fun with Talk Tennis. Cool. Okay. Welcome to Talk Tennis. Today we have the T squared Troy and Tim. Double the trouble. And
terrible too.
I mean, this could get nasty. We are going to talk. I generally am calling this form versus function, but it's going to be a deep dive. So if you've ever listened to episodes with Tim before.
I'm sorry.
You know, we can get weird. And if you've ever listened to episodes with Troy before, you know, we can get specific. So I feel like the blending.
Today we're going to get specifically weird.
That's what I was thinking right there.
That's going to be the name of the podcast. And then you have to deal with me trying to like make it make sense in my head on both the like technical and the non-technical stuff. And I just play tennis, so I feel like the endorphins are like flowing. And I have experiences that nice. I want to share.
Was it a good hit?
It was a good hit.
There we go. That's
Yeah.
It was a long rally.
Yes. The person that I hit with, thankfully, is like me. And we just hit for 60 minutes straight. No water. You can't. No water breaks. What? You don't need water.
That's not like when we hit. We got to get the water, change it. We talk for like 10 minutes.
We catch up on the tea. I know. We got to hit again.
It's like
more,
a social thing.
Yeah. No, this isn't social. I bring my rackets within 10 feet of the baseline. And I switch when we pick up the balls because you're out of the balls. And then, yeah, it's fun. It's a good time. You know who I mean. You know who I hit with.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, no warm up. Never, ever. And it's always like first thing in the morning. So that's always fun. How are you guys? How's the tennis going?
Good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you've been hitting some new rackets or no?
A couple.
Yeah. What? What do you like?
I hit the new blade.
Yeah.
The 1820.
Do you like it?
That was pretty nice.
Okay.
And also the E-Zone, that Yonex 98.
Just the regular 98?
It was just the regular 98.
No tour?
No. I didn't try it yet, but this one was, yeah, it was pretty good. Really.
Nice. And Troy?
Both really good rackets to be hitting with, you know?
Troy brought his emotional support racket today.
Yeah.
He's scared, so he brought it back up. This makes him feel safe.
It's so pretty.
It is pretty.
The glossy paint job. So we're testing this right now.
Yeah.
But it's on the website already.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a classic remake, kind of like what, you know, Wilson had in their pro labs. But it's dear to my heart because I used the older version of this for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like the 2012 and 2014, I think they were. 6195, 1820. So
nice.
I've been hoarding a couple of them, keeping them by my desk.
I know that feeling.
Talking to them at night.
Yeah. Don't let me down, baby.
Yeah.
Okay, I feel like this conversation can go in so many different directions, so I'm not sure where to start it. But I think the great debate today is the difference between form and function. Whereas we have someone like Tim, who believes that you can get away with hitting a tennis ball any way you like.
No.
Okay.
No.
But as long as it is functional, it works.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I would say, okay, so the big question is, right, what is the purpose of hitting a tennis ball, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you start off with what's the game all about? It's one person putting it in the rectangle more than another person. That's it. That's all it boils down to, right? And then, but that never comes up. It really never comes up because we always start off with, well, this is your grip and this is your swing and this is your stance and all this other kind of really, you know, jargon type stuff. And then you get to somebody years later. I always do years later, sometimes even in college, touring pros occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
What's the objective here?
Mm-hmm.
It's not, this isn't figure skating. You don't get points for hitting, you know. Oh, that was a beautiful shot. Stop the point. That was a 9.9.
Like style points.
Yeah, style points. Yeah. Right. Right?
Yeah.
So it's not that my suggestion is any old way doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. It's just that in my experience, the technique that matters is naturally occurring. Right? The thing that's not naturally occurring is understanding what's the objective of it all. Done.
Done. No. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks. Tune in next week. I feel like either Troy's thinking or
no. Like I totally agree with that, you know, and like I'm not gonna sit here and try to debate that at all, you know, like when you're coaching someone in the competitive tennis setting to win matches, to be a better player, you know, in the competitive setting, it's exactly right. But the other perspective, or the one that I've always kind of grown up with, my dad coaching me in youth sports, which was football, baseball, basketball. Later, you know, I picked up tennis. Was very much fundamentals and technique, trying to perfect the body's mechanics. And I guess not to say it's a counter argument, but for me, I've always been I'm a lefty. Mm-hmm. I think a little different. You know, mm-hmm. the different halves mm-hmm. of the mind. You know. Always have had that like creative perspective, that crafty perspective. And I also, you know, there's a big part, maybe not at the top level or competitive mindset, but a lot of us tennis players, recreational tennis players, that purely get enjoyment out of watching someone like Roger Federer hit the ball. Mm-hmm. Or even a crazy guy like Benoit Paire, who has that flair and that touch and that style. For some people, that's the biggest funnest part of tennis, not the X's and O's and points and break points and that type of thing. So that's kind of my perspective with it. Mm-hmm. And also, if you kind of go into the like the higher ranks, the competitive level, I think, not to say that as a coach you wouldn't coach fundamentals, just like you said, you can't hit the ball anyway, or there's certain ways that are better than others, but I think by having a great foundation in technique, fundamentals, you can reach a certain level of, you know, performance mm-hmm. Quicker or easier. And I think by not having those, you eventually will limit your cap at a certain level.
Do you think that? Would you agree?
By having certain flaws in your strokes, I think yeah. like serve and like certain ground strokes, I think at a certain level, there's ways of winning tennis matches without focusing on technique, but I think at a really high, like college level and above, you know, you're going to limit yourself at one point if you don't work on those things or try to make them mm-hmm. better.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing. And I'm also not presenting myself here as a person who knows. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I'm mm-hmm. saying I don't know, mm-hmm. right? That's sort of the cornerstone of my approach. I don't know. So I'm not going to tell you things I don't know.
Right.
Right. And it just seems to me that any limitation that shows up is also naturally occurring. Not everybody can be a great tennis player. Right? And also, from a tracking standpoint, not everybody's interested in it.
Right.
You know, very commonly we get people coming to us for lessons and we're like, they're all tracked the same. I'm going to turn you into a competitive player. Why that assumption?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, I'm just like, in my head, I'm thinking about people. We had a girl on our team. Like, the world is so small. She's actually related to someone that used to work here and played at Poly, who was the number one player, NCAA-ranked player. But, like, her backhand grip was you would never teach that. I mean, like, you would never suggest to someone that's how she should hold the racket. Yet it was incredibly effective. And, like, I played ITFs and all that and, like, was a very good player. She's probably still somewhere doing tennis things. But that's where in my head where it's like, because I lean into like what Tim does where he, or maybe I'm just going to own it as my own way, is that like you got to make it work in your own body. And like if that's having a funky, like I want to grab the racket, like having a funky backhand grip, but you can make it 10 times out of 10. Like she did something crazy like this. Yeah. Like it was psychotic.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, you know, I don't know. So that's where I just go.
It doesn't Medvedev have a weird grip?
His grips, you know, his takebacks, his follow-throughs are very much like give him this weird look on his shots. And one thing I wanted to talk about is like, yes, aesthetically, like certain people's strokes, we'll talk about like Medvedev, even though he's world class. And yeah. his strokes are not nearly as weird as what most people try to make him out to be or what you might see on your public court somewhere. But talking about the player, you know, played at Cal Poly.
Yeah.
Great player. Exactly, yeah. Or like a Medvedev. There's so much to the mechanics of the stroke, right? And one thing that I think is really cool that Agassi talks about, and I think we've maybe brought this up before, is that he talks about like hitting the ball and ball striking. Mm-hmm. You can do whatever you – I think we brought this up one time. You can do whatever you want on the take back here, mm-hmm, there, mm-hmm, whatever, you know, on these weird flares, kinks in your stroke. But there's like a window, yeah, he says, of like, you know, a foot or 16 inches or something in the strike zone where the racket face has to do something particular. I mean, you can't completely close a racket or completely open it and still get the ball in, you know, like at the highest level you can have really weird strokes, mm-hmm, but there's a certain window,
yeah,
where when you're striking the ball forehand or backhand,
it's got to be right.
You'll see pretty much the same thing from most pros,
yeah, you know, physically. Okay, that's, yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
I would say we sort of call that the slot,
yeah,
right? And if you look at that spot, like universally amongst players, it's very close,
yeah,
right? It's just that my contingent is it can't be taught. It's,
yeah,
just, that's a naturally occurring thing. Every ball's different.
Wait, okay. You know? So it can't be taught. I want to lean into, I like to lurk on the Reddit subreddits. I don't even know how to say it. Sorry. I'm such a Reddit noob. Like, I've only been on there for the last couple of years. But the tennis forms and the, like, oh, the, wow, TENNIS and the 10S. I see you guys. I see you every day. Rate my backhand. How can I improve my serve? What am I doing wrong? I'm a 3-5. Here's hitting footage. Like, what would you tell me? Like, what? First of all, what is this obsession? Because then that goes back to form. And second, how is that player supposed to improve? Because, you know, especially on Reddit, there's like 600. Am I the idiot telling this person? So many opinions. Like, who are you going to, like, actually listen to? And, like, how are they supposed to figure it out?
Right.
No, that's what I'm saying. And even, like, you're coaching players. You work. You see players all the time. What would you say to someone that just wants to get better? Which, again, like, what's better? More successful, win more matches. I would assume that's what most of us want to do.
You want to take it first?
Do they need to fix their form? Do they need to play more points? Should they be playing matches every day? And then eventually it sorts itself out, because if you keep doing the same thing over and over, you're either going to probably quit or figure it out. That's my opinion, but you guys tell me.
Yeah, and I just start off real quick, and then I want to hear what Tim says. But just like, yeah, what exactly is their objective?
Yes.
To get better, to win more matches?
And it's
strictly competitive?
Yeah.
I'm sure Tim has a great answer for
that. Well, my first question is, why do you want to be better?
There you go.
Right?
You're
imagining something's going to change.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? That's a big question. And usually when you, if you drill down long enough with somebody, you get this idea that, well, I'll be free from the struggle. Mm-hmm. I'll be free from the doubt. People will like me more. I'll be popular. And then somewhere down that road, I won't have to worry about ending up pushing all of my world's possessions in Target Basket down the street
or something
like that, right?
If I can get from 4-0 to 4-5, my life will be better.
Right. But you see, like, so this is an interesting point,
mm-hmm,
I think, because, like, to the idea of being better is the tyranny of an imaginary future you, right? And should you ever get to that imaginary future you will find that it too is ruled by another imaginary future you, right? And the proof of that is, like, the best players in the world are the most miserable tennis players. There's no doubt about that. They are struggle as much as anybody. They have less confidence most of the time,
except Roger.
Even then, he just didn't
like Andy Murray
and Djokovic.
Yeah,
I mean, like, Djokovic always comes to mind too.
And then also, just touching on that exact topic, say the person gets to where they think they want to be the 4-5 and the best player in my club or something. And then they get there and they're still going to deal with the same struggles or wanting to achieve more or still having the same outlook. And there was a video I just watched recently. I watch a lot of Kobe Bryant inspirational videos. And he talked about, like, winning and losing and about, like, how when he won a championship or he won certain things, yes, it's great, but it's whatever. Like, in his mind, it's whatever. Or losing. Do you get depressed and this and that? And he has natural reactions. He says it. But why take the winning so high or the losing so low? Because tomorrow you got to show up and you got to do the same. thing again. And he was trying to like separate himself from the natural reaction, like you're saying, wanting more. And then when you get there, it's going to be, I want more, I want more, I want more. You know, he was trying to like put himself in a mind state to.
Well, that's the way you said it was important, right? Separate himself.
Yeah.
Right. So to me, when you're free from the need to be better, it's the only time you're ever going to be better.
I literally referenced you yesterday. I was having a deep chat with someone in this building about stuff. And I'm going back. I'm throwing it back because this has set, since you said it, it's resonated with me and I can't not think about it like on a daily basis. When we have, there's certain people in this life and I'm one of them that's like always like, gotta live every day better than yesterday. And then Tim dropped the, well, if you're talking like that, then that means that you didn't think you did well yesterday. Like you didn't do a good job yesterday. And like, yeah, that's such that.
And you're missing the beauty in 10 years down the road. You're going to be looking back like, that was a beautiful time in my life that I never really stopped and looked, yeah, at what I had around me, you know?
Yeah. I mean, this thing that you're dissatisfied with is the only thing you're ever going to know. This is all there is, right? And so
it's too early in the morning. Right,
quite seriously, the need to be free, you know, the need to be free from it is what's driving people crazy. And so if you can get away from the need to be better, that's when better starts to happen.
Do you know what? And because I have been actively, I'm always actively working on it, which is against the whole Romy Rose. Today, you asked if I had a good hit, and I said yes. And okay, yeah, I was striking the ball well, but I didn't get mad at myself. I've been really, really trying to just like chill the F out on the court. I am like really trying not to like berate myself. I'm really trying, I'm really trying to change that self-talk. That if you know, you know. I don't know. Tim doesn't, I don't know. Do you even have that?
And then like also I'm thinking too, like on the other end, like when you are beating yourself up or, oh yeah, I had a bad day on court. For what?
Who cares?
Are you going to go play a tournament next month?
No.
Are you training for that?
No.
Then, like, go
who
out there.
Who cares? I know.
And that's kind
it's
of...
It's supposed
that,
to be fun.
And that's why when we first started this talk about, like, you know, winning matches, the percentages, just getting the ball inside the rectangle. And I'm thinking, you know, like, definitely, I totally agree with that. But then, you know, people like myself, and there's a lot of rec players that, you know, like you said, why do you even want to be better? You know, because there's players like me who now I'm out of the competitive world for the most part. You know, I just want to hit a Roger backhand. You know, a lot of people just want to do that.
Right, right.
Go hit that stroke.
But
you know?
Even like if you are a 3-5 playing 3-5 USTA, and let's say you're on two leagues, you play twice a week, it's totally cool to just like always be a 3-5. I'm like mad respect for those people like who are just like, I love this. I don't need to get better. Like I like to win, but I also am here for like the environment, to be on the court, the exercise, the social aspect. With that being said,
right, but it's the why, right? The why is if I want to be struggle free, better's not, you know, being a better tennis player is not going to do that.
No.
Right? Struggle free comes from freeing yourself from the struggle. What you're talking about. Just okay, fine. This is it. I'm fine with myself. That doesn't, and it also mean it does not mean you're not going to get better,
right?
Right, because that's a naturally occurring process. Just like you didn't grow yourself, you didn't consciously grow yourself to this height, right?
I wouldn't have stopped, dude.
Right, yeah, right, yeah. Right. So it's. I mean, for lack of a better term, it's kind of like everybody has an ability DNA too that you're born with, a range that's possible, right? Mm. And so what we were talking about in the other podcast is, I think a great deal of coaching limits that range. Mm-hmm. Right, they stop people, they stymie people from getting to that range by saying like, oh no, your elbow has to be right here, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Or you have to be like this, mm-hmm. right?
I'm laughing only because I know.
I mean, really specific things like that, right? Yeah. And so you're gonna, if you take your foot off your own throat first, okay, now the struggle's over. Mm-hmm. Now you're just enjoying this. And then the better happens. Yeah. You play it because you enjoy it, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Or because maybe you're very driven and you want to get good, that's fine too. But it's not, the good is not your identity anymore. Yeah. Your identity is just like, I'm just a dude. You know, this we could say might be true about a guy. Can we mention names and stuff like Federer and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this might be true of him. He struck me as a guy. I don't know him. You know, I've never talked to him. But he strikes me as a guy who's like very cool with who he is. He's comfortable in his own suit. you know?
I will say what I think about Roger, which is also that he's awesome. But I think because of who he is, he also surrounds himself with people who can do the hard stuff for him, if that makes sense. So, like, his agent is, like, a very strong personality. And so, like, he's kind of created this world where he can just show up and do what he loves and enjoy every minute of it in that way. And kind of, like, I don't know, is leaning into the good life, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah, he seems – and another guy, Mats Wielander, I know pretty well.
Yeah.
I worked with him for a while. That guy, you would never, ever, ever guess he was a number one tennis player.
Yeah. And he's just
– he's just cool with who he is.
Yeah.
I think he always was.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool.
You know,
and then, you've got other personalities who, like – I mean, we see, like, McEnroe or your – your
or
you know.
Lately.
Yeah.
Kyrgios.
Yeah,
look
yeah.
at how talented that guy is, how much skill – you know, his serve, the certain things that, you know, a lot of people could strive their whole life and never do.
Totally.
And he talks about, you know, a lot on the mental health side in his podcast and stuff lately, but how much, you know, he didn't love himself. You know, he didn't want to be in his own skin.
Right?
Yeah. You know? Could you hit a ball better than that guy?
Can you?
Could
no.
There's no way.
Yeah.
No, I don't
think so. I was like, well, Troy, like,
drop shot challenge. Drop shot challenge. But no.
Did you listen to the episode with Osaka yet?
Not yet.
Okay,
no.
I listened to it this morning. It's interesting. It's because both those people, anyways, it's an interesting, and it kind of, like, leans into, like, obviously the mental health, the where they are, because she took a break, and now he's taking a break, and yeah. Anyway,
I mean, I think it can drive you crazy.
Oh, yeah.
To the better point, you know, the idea of better, right? I've been behind him when he's hitting balls. You cannot hit a ball better. I mean, the sound when he hits a ball, it's ridiculous. It's, like, yeah. It's just like perfect, you know?
Literally.
I mean, yeah, really, it's unbelievable.
No, I know. Really...
And then it's crazy, too, bringing the gear into
yeah,
the
I was going to say.
It's like he's supposedly one of the few players on tour that doesn't really weight his racket. So he plays with the E-Zone 98. And, like, it's pretty much stock. I think a leather grip. I don't think he changes the swing weight much. Doesn't play with a dampener. And to have that kind of sound, you know?
Yeah. So clean and crisp.
Such a, you know, it's not like he's, you know, Roger, like some of these guys, Andy Murray, Stan, that have beefy rackets where you kind of get, like, the rackets mashing through the ball. Kyrgios is so much racket head speed and just the...
Not, and just, like, flow. Yeah. When he's in the state of flow.
Yeah.
The mind, body... I don't know. There's a word. I want to talk about gear, though. And there's a couple different ways I want to go for gear. Troy and I have been talking a lot about pro stock rackets, so we're going to bring that up. However, I also want to talk about, like, gear being, like, rackets specifically and strings being able to help or hurt your game. And I think we see it differently because we work here and, like, before I ever worked here, you could have told me, like, oh, no, you shouldn't be playing with that racket. And I would have been like, shut up. You don't know me. But now I see so many players playing with rackets and I'm like, is that really the best fit for them? Or, like, what if you tried this and all of a sudden their game changes? And I today had an experience on the court hitting with a certain racket and was, like, super happy and, like, loving it. It's not normally one that I would like or gravitate towards. 18-20, all these things. Okay, maybe Troy's trying to make me have an 18-20 year.
Yeah.
I've never, but then
I think her whole life, you know, she was missing out on the fact that her swing stroke style works great with that type of pattern.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
Oh, you pound the ball.
But then I went straight back.
You don't really use a lot of spin unless you need to on the angles, and you can still do it. But
I went straight from there. I like to do, like, a 15-minute hit with each racket. I went to the Pure Drive Tour, and I could not keep a ball in the court. And all of a sudden, I had to completely change the way I was hitting. And my literal, the way, like, my flashback to college where it was like, Michelle, be more consistent. Like, you need to have a 75% rally ball, and you need to work the point and whatever. And I'm thinking, like, I didn't have to work the point with that racket I was using before. I could just hit out. I had confidence. Anyways, so that made me, like, go into this whole, like, oh, my gosh, maybe Troy's right. Maybe I've always used the wrong racket.
But then I just watched the Kim Kleister's podcast and how much Michelle was like, you know, her and, like, Kim even talked about it. She's like, yeah, I just loved it from the get go. And I never thought about changing. If anything, like, if I wouldn't make the racket have adaptations or customizations. I just made them myself, you know? Yeah. And then Michelle's like, yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
But that's the thing. And then everyone's like, well, why do you like the strings so tight? Well, that's why I like strings so tight, because that's where I can build in the control. And like, for me, that's just become what I've liked. So tell me what you guys think about like how gear can actually help or hurt your game. Or do you think that's baloney?
No, I definitely think it can. I mean, in a grand sense, like if you pick up a super lightweight, if you're a pretty good player and you pick up a super lightweight racket, you cannot return a well-hit ball.
What if that's all you knew?
I think it would hold you back.
Yeah.
I do think it would hold you back.
And I was going to say, that was one of like my first big points with, it's really tough in say like the racket industry and like helping customers and helping people find the right racket, is that right, wrong, or indifferent, when a player starts off at a young age, say maybe like Michelle when she's little or something, and they get put into a racket, or you know their coach recommended something and they didn't know what they were talking about, or they just picked up a racket just out of straight opportunity, no, didn't have anything else, maybe didn't have the funds or whatever, and then they play with it for like 5-10 years and they get so ingrained in that feel that even if it is a really bad racket for them or maybe limiting their playing ability, it's so hard to change them after that. Because you can put them in something that's great, you would think, for their game. If they hit flat, you know, an 18, 20, something more flexible, and they'll just hate it every time. And they'd literally have to spend like a year or two to try to transition to that racket till it feels probably normal to them or somewhat. And in most players' careers, if they're competitive and they're trying to get better, you don't have that time to just sit out and just work on adapting to a racket.
Yeah.
So that's really tough.
And it's, yeah.
Yeah, if you're that far down the road, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I had a guy on my team this year, and he had this is his second year playing.
Yeah.
And he had just one of those metal adult rackets. Yeah. You know, those like big five jobs, right? It's like cost like $10,
titanium
whatever.
Or whatever.
Yeah, something like that. And he could
no
not
grommets.
Well, yeah, he, even when he lined up the ball, it would not go anywhere.
Yeah,
right. And so I gave him one of the rackets we had laying around. I said, here, just take that one.
Yeah,
like within 2 weeks
he got better.
Oh, it's way better,
because he could actually like,
well, yeah, you could actually the feedback, I think the body's looking for this feedback, it's not getting it from this particular stick here, you know, so he gets this other one, and now all of a sudden he's like, now he's a totally different player, and it took less than a month.
So do you think ever, like, when there's that player saying, like, rate my backhand, what am I doing wrong, fix this, like, do you ever think that gear could be somewhere that they should maybe, like, also consider, like, if they're putting the money in for the coaching? And I mean, like, and it sounds silly, but, like, it's, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with that feedback, too. Like, not to say that, you know, you give them, they have a cheap $30 racket that they got from a big box store, and then you give them a brand new Pure Drive, and they're going to go to 4.5 to 5.0.
Right.
But the feedback, you know, start with fresh strings. See if they can feel the ball and the strings a little better. Some players are using some cheap sin gut that's all out of position and frayed.
Been there since you they bought the racket.
You put them in a new string, and maybe say they are pretty decently advanced. You put them in a hybrid with a poly, and now they're starting to grab the ball. And they're like, oh, my backhand, I can work the angles easy. I can feel it. Or even just a new frame and the ball on the strings, and you get that plow through, that solid feel from a nice graphite frame like the Blade or the V-Core or anything like that. You know, it's like, that's a good place to start. Not to say that, oh, gear's going to take me to the Challenger circuit, you know, or whatever. But definitely there is a difference there. And if the player has the time in the off season, has a little bit of, you know, funding, or their parents helped them out, or if even if they're adult, you know, I think it's worth the investment of starting with the string job and then working their way into a legit frame.
Yeah.
Finding something that feels good and gives them that feedback, that response.
And demoing, I think, is super important. Actually, I don't know if I told you this. Troy and I did like a Prince demo day at one of the local clubs, and one of the teaching pros there had been, I think she was using an E-Zone. They're actually going to sectional playoffs this weekend, but she hit with a Prince Tour for the first time. I think it was one of the 100s. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was one of the 100s. And she like was like, wait, why is this so much easier than my racket? And like, she was like kind of obsessed to the point where she's like, Michelle, I need to get a new racket. I'm like, great. Like, come see us. So she ended up, she ended up buying the Tour 100. Is it 290, 300? or is it 290, 305, or
there's 290, and then the 100P is 305, and then there's the 310.
Yeah. Okay, so she bought the 310 and instantly was like, this is too heavy, and like did not like it, and then she went back and got the 290, and now she's like dialed in. But it was like, it was cool because especially like teaching pros, sometimes you're not playing a lot of tennis, you know, you're feeding a lot, but she like is on a team and she's playing a decent amount, so she just realized instantly that this was an easier racket for her. She was making more balls in the court, and then when she did get it, she got the one that was too hard for her and then instantly made the correction. So just like, and she's very knowledgeable in tennis, you know.
Yeah, weight's a huge deal.
Yeah.
That can be way too heavy.
And balance.
And balance. Yeah, I mean, and you develop preferences, you know. It's very difficult to, I find it like very difficult to volley with a head heavy racket.
Mm-hmm.
I know people who like it, but I don't like it.
Mm-hmm. Or they're like Rafa, and when he goes up to the net, he chokes up like this. I was watching
crazy.
Him practice the other day, and I know he has a pretty high swing weight based on like the origin specs and stuff, and it's pretty close to even balance. But you watch him practice his volleys, and he's like up here.
Really?
Yeah. So he's cutting
off the middle. That's so interesting.
Yeah, and he doesn't use an extended length racket really, but yeah.
Okay, well, so the next topic on gear, we wanted to talk a little bit about pro stock, pro rackets. It's become, I mean, like, okay, yes, it's not a secret. There are pros playing with rackets that us mere mortals cannot get access to. Period. The end. However, I will die on this one. There are pros out there, maybe not in the top 25, that are using rackets off the shelf. With that being said, are these pro stock rackets really that magical that A, that's why they're in the top 25, or B, someone that is a 3-5-4-0 that gets a hold of it is going to instantly become a better player?
I don't think so. No.
But the mystique.
Sorry.
I think it's the mystique that like.
Like they have something we don't.
You know, maybe a Novak or a Murray can get these, you know. Whether it's an older model frame or a custom frame, and then, you know, say some of these brands might tweak with the layup. That's the thing that's really mysterious about pro stocks. Whether, you know, a lot of pros, they're not necessarily using something that was never invented or never brought to market. It's a lot of times just older retail.
Yes.
And they're kept in the vault and brought back or whatever. But the layup thing, that's one thing that I think kind of is the mystique, or these people on the message boards, oh my God, he has the old Prestige or the old Radical from 20 years ago, but it's got this custom layup where Chris, if you watch the video when he went to the, I believe it was the factory in Kennelbach, and they talk about layups. They talk about how they lay the graphite to make it softer here, stiffer here. They tweak the angles of the sheets that they use of the graphite. And so, you know, the fact that these people get caught up like, oh yeah, he's using the old Radical, but it's softer than the retail or whatever. Like say we have the old classic head rackets. Like we had the Head Pro Tour 2.0, which is like a original predecessor, the one that came before the Prestige, the blue one.
Right.
And it came out to market, and when we did the stiffness ratings, it was like in the low 60s, like mid to low. And everybody's like, oh, that's not original Pro Tour, what is it, the 630 or the 280 or whatever it was back then. Because those were all like 57 stiffness, so it's a different layup. And yeah, maybe it is. But I remember the first time I hit with it, and I was like, oh, this plays pretty good. But if it was any more flexible, I probably wouldn't like it. It'd be like completely dead.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're just so caught up in like, oh, I want the one with the Toron in it from 1998 that Guga hit with, you know.
It's what we want, what we can't have.
Yeah.
There's some people pretty much obsessed with this stuff too.
Oh, right? Obsessed.
You know, they're like.
And I mean, I to a certain extent, I kind of get into the.
He's obsessed. No.
into the, you know,
sorry,
specs
Troy,
and
we're
all
talking
that.
About you.
But that's why I brought this today. You know, it's like a remake of a 6-1 that I used to play with, and it's great. Like the stiffness, we just spec the stiffness on these. And I know they've done a couple remakes, and there was one where like the stiffness, the average stiffness on them was like 67.
Yeah.
And that's a little high because I know like the K Factor 6-1, the one that Granville used to use, was like 68 or 69. I was like, ah, oh, that's a little much. But these ones, me and Wolf specced a bunch of them, and they're like 64, 65, so it's like perfect. Like, I like the fact that it's like a little softer. And then supposedly, I don't know, I haven't cracked one of these or cut one of these Wilson Pro Lab rackets open.
Yeah.
But I know like a lot of the Pro Lab or Pro Stock rackets that they would give to their touring pros are foam injected.
Okay.
And you'll see that with a lot of pro rackets and even some of the retail stuff like Technifiber and Dunlop. They both do foam fill frames, Celinco as well. Mm-hmm. But when you hit with this, it's like, oh, it's got that mid 60 stiffness. So it's got that, you know, pop to it, but it does feel very like shock absorbing. And I think they're, you know, there quite likely could be some foam inside these frames here from the Pro Lab. So I think that's kind of cool.
I am asking, I was going to fun fact you guys that the racket that I played well with was indeed a Pro Stock racket. I'm trying to see, and it's a racket that I normally would not necessarily like be like, oh my God, you guys, I love this racket. However, I'm asking what the stiffness is, just out of curiosity, to see if the stiffness had changed a little bit. If I actually would assume it would be a little stiffer than what the inline racket says, but that's, yeah.
But as an 1820, you were also liking and playing pretty well, at least from what I recall, with the new V9.
The blade, 1820. Like
or even the Dunlop 1820, the CX, which is a 95.
I like that one too.
If we were to customize that one up to the spec of the Pro Stock,
I like this one too. What's happening? Except then I go back. Except then I go back to the RF97, and I'm like, huh, why would we ever leave this?
Yeah.
And just everyone out there, you had a chance to buy the RF97 and play with what Roger plays with. You had your chance. It's off the market now. All sold out. Sold out. I have all of them.
He didn't use that racket though, did he?
Yes. Oh my gosh. See? Really?
That was off. He was off the shelf?
No, different layup.
Wait, and then like we won't do it because we don't have the time, but don't even start about the paints.
Oh, really?
The different paint feels different. And like Troy loves a glossy racket.
Lately.
Versus, like, can you feel a difference?
It's hard because not too often do you get to hit the same exact racket in two paint jobs.
That's true.
But the trend of like some of these glossy, like the Pro Labs, like the Ultra Pro and this, or what else has come out lately that's like a glossy finish, you know, they're, they have a, you know, certain feel. But like unless you're able to hit the same racket with the same layup and the same specs with like three different paint jobs, it'd be hard to make that, you know, claim.
Yeah. Do you think it's because you can feel it in your left hand? Or your right hand?
Oh, you mean like the...
Chris does that. Chris does that comment.
It's like a very noticeable difference in feel.
Yeah.
Like, I know, for example, if you give me two rackets of the same weight, similar rackets, right? Same weight, but one has a very thin beam. It feels more maneuverable to me.
Like it cuts, yeah.
Yeah, it just feels that way because I can feel it in my hand, right?
Yeah.
I'm waiting in my hand and it just feels more maneuverable.
Yeah.
It's not. I know it's not, but it's a weird.
Yeah.
I know Chris always talked about that with the Pro Staff 85, the Sampras racket when we play with it. Like it has a heavy spec, but like the swing weight and the really thin beam and the smaller compact head, it just, you know, it kind of came through the air differently.
Yeah.
And you don't think about drag and that kind of thing, but when you play with a big chunky, super thick frame and compare it to a midsize, even if the midsize is heavier, there's just something there. You know?
Yeah. I don't know how real that is.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if there's ever been like,
if
you could even test it.
Crawford?
The area.
Let's just bring it back. Thin beam, small head size, short shorts. The short shorts are already coming back, man.
Why not?
You know?
The middle's the middle. Doesn't matter how big the head is.
Right?
Yeah.
In a slightly different conversation about gear, I wanted to ask you to, if you can think back of a technology that really stood out to you that actually like seemed to be like Troy's smiling. No,
Troy's ready.
I'm spinning. Let's get to this question, and then I'm spinning on another question. After that.
So like a lot of times, you know, we had a comment the other day about like a certain brand's technology has been the same through the last like three iterations, and it gets confusing, and they use these words that mean nothing to the consumer, and like hopefully you can feel the difference between this generation compared to last one and the one before and the one before that. So has there, and there is a racket that's probably going to come up, but has there been anything that's like stood out to you that's like, yes, this technology like felt different and to me felt like an improvement, so like would help me play better?
First ones that I just talked about with the foam fill stuff. Mm-hmm. I think when Dunlop started doing that Sonicore Infinergy on their rackets, mm-hmm. I think that was really good.
Yeah.
And I also like to shout out Dunlop too, because I think they get overlooked a lot and they have some really good rackets. It's just, they don't have a ton of tour support.
What was cool about that technology is when we got presented it, they showed us what it looked like.
It looked like Adidas Boost.
Yeah. And so that's always been a very visible like connection, which I think is cool too.
But that, when they incorporated that, and then Technifiber too.
Yeah.
When Technifiber started doing, I forget what the name is. Of their technology with the foam.
It's not the RS,
it's the beam shape. I can't think of the name of it right now, but it's also another injected in the hoop, like a foam.
I got you. I'll get it. I'll bring it up. Let's see.
Something inside? Like on the TF40?
Isoflex? No, that's ISO. Foam giving it, T-Fight has been injected with foam, giving it a wonderfully solid feel.
Maybe they just call it like a foam injection. Yeah.
Period.
But I think those two rackets were really well improved with that addition. What about you? Anything you noticed, Tim?
I
just pick up a racket. Exactly. And it feels good. I
sometimes I'm like, wait, whose racket is this?
Yeah.
He's got like some old ones in the shed, and he'll just grab them.
Oh, the old, like there was a Prestige. It was the one that was red, had the silver here and here.
Old.
Old, yeah.
Oh, I think it might be like UTEC IG.
I love that racket.
Yeah.
Well, UTEC IG seems to be a popular technology that comes up a lot with head that people like really resonated with. DR was what I was thinking. The E-Zone, the DRs, everyone like loved that technology.
And AI came in. AI and DR were great. Going back to the older head rackets, I think from like Microgel to UTEC IG, really, really good filling rackets. And then when they jumped ship and they went to get the first generation of graphene, mm-hmm. not going to say it was bad or anything. It just was, definitely noticeably different. And I think they gradually refined it. And I know they have all these crazy names now, Auxetic 2.0 and stuff like that. And but I think the head rackets have definitely gotten back to really good feel mm-hmm. with the way they're infusing the Auxetic and all that stuff. What's the other one? Not Auxetic, but they're
on head.
Is it spiral fibers? Are they the same thing, or is it
on
the current ones?
It's Auxetic 2.0, right? And then it pairs with, hold on.
Yeah, I'm forgetting the name of the other part, but.
The technology. Auxetic 2.0 to the layup, Speed Pro 360 Plus, graphene inside. I don't know which racket. That was the head Speed Pro.
The new one?
Yeah, newest. Let's see. Boom? Does Boom have it? I don't know. That's the thing that's tough is sometimes morph beam, that's Boom's beam.
Yeah.
Just sometimes it just, you see these words and it's hard to like understand what that means or feels like.
Right.
Like, I don't know. So I'm like, oh, you lost me with the tech. But
yeah, I remember like those and then like going back through Wilson, the Encode, K-Factor had some good rackets. K-Factor in general was a little stiffer. Encode was, you know, good feel. Then they went to like BLX for all those years, and most of the BLX frames were good. And then I know not everybody disliked it, but like when they went to the Countervale, it was very like
muted.
You liked it or you didn't? Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And then I think lately they've gotten
back
pretty good with the feel of the racket. So
yeah,
a lot of times the technology is just like something small that they, you know, will tweak inside the frame or the layup. As far as like big technologies, I mean, Prince had the holes. They still do. They still have the ports on some of them.
That's a big deal.
Which is very much a different feel in it.
Also very gravitating. Like yeah. you either like it or you hate it, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah. Nice.
And then there's the extended length rackets. That's a physical.
That's a little bit back now, right?
I think so. I think us as Tennis Warehouse and the playtest team have kind of
yeah, we've revived
it. Pushed that with some of the brands, and they've kind of responded.
Yeah, and now there's Slinko has 2 28-inch yeah. rackets.
Really?
Yeah, I think they're fun. I don't know if they're realistic, but they're again. What's your objective? If I'm not playing matches, which I'm not. And I just want to have fun and blast the ball as hard as I can.
Oh, yeah, I know that. Yeah.
Hitting a 28-inch racket is really fun.
And that's another thing, too, the extended length that's kind of part of the pro stock, where it's like something any pro can usually get from their brand, mm-hmm. even if they don't make it, like as a racket on the market.
Because don't the rackets come out 28 inches and then
or
they can
or
cut
longer.
It?
Sometimes yeah. they come out like 29 or 30 yeah. and they chop them down, or 29 probably, but they cut them down to what they can – chop them to what they want.
And a lot of pros have like slightly extended, it sounds like, from what I've heard, allegedly.
Does anybody serve with one racket and return with another?
In their back.
I don't know if it ever happened.
Right? I mean, does that ever happen?
Okay, well, which racket would you serve with and which one would you return with?
Serve with a long racket.
Which one? Slinko.
I don't know. Yeah, I'd serve with the long racket and return with the...
Just go grab it real quick without...
Like, dude, that would be so funny. We should do it.
Yeah, just like...
Just grab it like by your bench and...
Well, they change racks all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
You could do it on the changeover.
You would play a whole service game. I thought you meant literally serve and then try it.
Like a Swiss Army knife.
I was like, let's see a different woman to get to the net. I got one.
Hey, I serve slow enough. I serve slow enough to do that.
My right hand. I was going to say, you can't serve very fast. Wait, that would be so interesting.
Right. I don't know for sure.
Because they use different
strength tensions. I know they use different
tensions.
Yeah. I don't know if they use different lengths.
I don't think so.
Some of the pros have their rackets like numbered and stuff.
Yeah. I feel like it's so weird because that's not weird. I feel like the pros like all want everything to feel the same.
Yeah.
I'm like one of those that I want options, man. I want a racket with a 330 swing weight, a 333, a 336, a 339. Go ahead.
Well, especially as the match progresses, right?
Yeah.
I remember that story about Gonzalez drilling out his rackets.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
He drilled holes in his rackets. He was playing Wimbledon. He was like 40 years old, and he was playing, I think, maybe Charlie Passerell.
Okay.
And it was the longest match until that other match recently, a few years ago. It was the longest match. It was 2 days, right? And Gonzalez, being older, he knew that he would tire. And so he drilled out holes. It was a wooden racket.
To make it lighter?
Yeah, he drilled out holes, and then progressively. And then he covered them with wooden dowels so you couldn't tell.
What?
Yeah. And then as the match went on, it was like a 6 or 7 hour match, something like that. I don't remember.
He just asked for a drill?
No, he did it at home. Oh. He prepared for this. Right, and then he would, as the match went on, he would grab different rackets, and then he won.
Just remove some weight, you know.
Variety is the spice of life.
So yeah, you have different swing weights as you.
That's cool.
Getting the fifth set.
That's like, my vibe. I need something. I need to fix whatever.
I get a thought.
Let's hear it.
As soon as you brought up the serve with one racket, return with the other.
Okay.
Not equipment change, but I have with the modern game things progressing. I've seen like some videos of some kids that have been pointed out that are like world-class players, and I forget the names, and I think there's maybe like one or two of them, but there was a junior player that was highlighted that plays with a forehand on both sides, a right-handed forehand and a left-handed forehand, and some I've seen serve on different sides. So maybe what are your thoughts on that as like the game progresses? And also,
there was a
pro coach that I was following, and he was talking about, you know, there's a constant debate about the one-handers. And lately, in the last like 6 months or so, when there was no one-handed backhand in the top 10 mm-hmm. for like the first time.
Until Dimitrov, right?
So they were talking about the pros and cons of the one-hander versus the two, obviously, and we could go into that. But the main thing he was talking about is the return of serve. And he says that he thinks maybe one day there'll be players that use the two-hander just for the return, and then they play the point from the baseline with a one-e. But they stick with the two hands on, like, the return of serve only.
Interesting.
There might be, like, some hybrids like that. And, I mean, I kind of thought it was cool because, like, during reviews and stuff, like, I have like five backhands, you know, yeah. Like I'll hit the slice, I'll hit the slice drop shot, I'll roll it with one, I'll roll it with two, you know, like.
And then everyone's like, when did Troy switch? And you're like, it's all here. I got it all, man.
One, it's like, I just like having fun. Two, I like being like, oh, I can hit any shot in the world, you know, in the book, but yeah.
That's interesting. The two forehands thing is blowing my mind a little bit.
I mean, that's old school. That's a little Mo, right?
Yeah.
Warren Conley, yeah. Both sides, right? It was not that uncommon.
Yeah.
In the 1920s, I think. Luke Jensen served equally well with both right and left hands. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Those were his
right. That guy was amazing. His left-handed serve was – his right-handed serve was amazing. His left-handed serve was amazing, right? I always took the two-handed dominance as because we start kids so early now, and they can't swing a one-handed backhand.
Yeah.
Right. So I always figured if they started a little bit later and, you know, we just sort of let go, you know, they would, because there's an aesthetic, to your point. There's a one-handed aesthetic.
Yeah. But I think even Roger said, didn't he say it in an interview? He's like, if I taught my kids, I think this was a while ago,
he
would probably teach them the two.
I mean, I'm thinking I love hitting that? Two-handed backhands. Like, you can just mash the ball in a different way that you can't mash the ball with a one-handed.
Yeah, you can. You've seen Stan?
Oh, yeah. This is another thing. I up until a few years ago, I would have bet any amount of money that you could not hit a one-hander
harder than
a two-hander.
Two, yeah.
And then I saw Lubicic. Remember Lubicic?
Yeah.
I saw him at Palm Springs.
Yeah.
Holy smokes. He hit a one-handed backhand. It was over 110 miles an hour.
Yeah. I mean, if you think of the biomechanics, you can actually get more whip and bigger range of motion with one. The two hands, especially for, I mean, like me, but like you watch Agassi and he's very like, he's got the big shoulders, and, like, he doesn't get a lot of range. It's very quick and snappy, you know? But the problem is when you get outside of that wheelhouse, like, that ball that's right on the tee up here, the return, that's when the one-e's tough, you know? But, like, right here, you can get, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
There's less room for error on the two hands, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah.
But yeah, you can have a bigger swing arc with a one-hander, right? And that's more racket energy at the end.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually a little bit liable on high balls.
Yes.
Right?
But so are two-handers. No one wants to kick your backhand.
Yeah, that's a universal problem in tennis is what to do with balls above your shoulder.
Yeah.
Right? That is a universal.
Exactly.
Unless you're Murat Safin or Joe Sanga and you do the jumping.
As hard as you can.
One of boof, you know.
Yeah. But
what about the hybrid, the return with the two and then play with a one-handed crafty style? Like, have that variety, but then the...
Why not? I mean, it's just like, are you, winning is so important at such an early age, right? That nobody develops, well, not nobody, but I've never seen anybody develop the requisite fluency to pull that off, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're just, if this works, you know, don't fix what isn't broken, let's just go, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody might have an artistic, and we've talked about this in previous casts, right? This, to me, it's art. You know, but always people are stepping on the art with the winning, right?
They're just stepping on the art with their opinions.
Well, yeah, we don't have time. Well, okay, back to what you said earlier about rally balls in college, right? You need a rally ball unit. Why do you need that? Why does somebody have to put that in your head?
Yeah, I just hit the ball as hard as I can into the corners. I don't need a rally ball.
Yeah, why don't you just, you know, and so, you know, we've coached together before. Like, if I'm coaching somebody, just show me how you want to play, right? Forget about everything else.
Well, okay, that goes back. This goes back to the form versus function, and like this is where Troy would say that's technically wrong, and I would say, but I can do it. My backhand, I was taught to hit open stance, SoCal. That's what we did in the 90s. We did open stance, right?
King Richard, baby.
Let's go. So for the longest time, I fought. Okay, you want to be open stance on your backhand. My body does not want to go open stance on my backhand. It does not feel right. I am crossing my right foot over my left, and I am hitting my backhand. Does it look right? No. Is it most effective? Maybe not. But for me, yes. And that's what we're doing.
But, like, there's so many other parts of your backhand that are, like, amazing. Like,
I thought you were going to say that are messed up.
The way your two hands work together.
Yeah,
Your left hand, the way you get it to, like, come up and get the topspin when you need it, but the drive, so you can get the left hand.
Try seize my backhand.
But the one that really I like, is, and I remember it started coming out. What review was it? I think it was the EGA racket.
Okay.
The EGA. Remember the first EGA tempo?
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm playing a little more crafty with this kind of like EGA.
Yeah, because I got the angles.
And you started working the roll, the backhand roll cross court with the topspin. And I was like, oh, I love that about Michelle's backhand. Like when you start using the spin. Plus the drive, you know, so that you can say, you know, your stance and maybe it's not great for your hip or your knee, you know, but like
this is not
there's so many
sound.
Things going good here.
That
thanks
it
to
saves
Robert.
It.
Thanks to Robert Landstor.
Thank you. He's probably like, I don't know.
Yeah, that it's like.
He's like that forehand. Yes, that's mine. Backhand. Nah.
And then there was like, I remember one time we did a video. Maybe it was on someone's phone or something. Or maybe it was when we had PlaySight and we recorded. I think we were hitting and then we got the camera to flip.
Yes.
So Michelle was a lefty and I was like, dude, I never noticed it till it went lefty. But I was like, a lot of your shots were just like Kvitova.
Kvitova.
I was like, damn, Michelle looks just like Kvitova.
It was crazy.
I didn't notice it until she turned into a lefty, you know?
And I've gotten that before, like, oh, like you play like Kvitova. And I'm like. No, well, I like her, so.
Yeah, I don't think, nothing's excluded, right?
No. I don't know.
Well,
is
I mean,
it? But no, it is for certain people.
The stepping across, right? So I always figure, like, when you don't have time, when you're arranging your feet to hit a ball and you don't have time, you just go with what you got.
Right.
It's just, it's like a crisis. But when you have time, you want to, you would like to step in as much as you can.
Yeah.
But when you're on the move, specifically like on a backhand, right, and you're stepping across yourself, then it requires an extra step.
Right.
That takes you out of the court. But there's ways to recover for that if it's there, right? And also it's a bit of a liability on clay, right? It's very hard to slide that way. But then I'll remind you that Borg won about 6 French Opens doing that.
Probably could have had more, huh?
Yeah. One year, it was a player's boycott. He missed 1 year because there was a boycott of the French Open.
Crazy.
Right. And then I would take him, like with modern technology, pound for pound against pretty much anybody. You know, to this day.
That's another podcast.
Except for that guy from Mallorca, right?
Well, that guy's great. I mean,
that would be a fun match to watch.
An amazing
match.
Did he
lose today, though?
He did.
Oh, but we're saying best. At
I'm not. I'm saying, like, you know, you look at the athleticism. Mm-mm. I mean, Borg was incredibly fast, as is Rafa. You know, I mean, there's not like a great difference between them athletically.
Although I just saw a video.
Did you really?
I'm debunking it.
Okay,
but I saw a video. It's a coach. I think he's down in San Diego or Vegas, one of the two. And he reposted a video from like way back when I think Borg was still playing, or maybe it was that little after. But it was like the top athletes of the time, and they did like a sprint. It was like Borg, Pele, or one of the guys, the soccer players, and then Gretzky, and someone else.
Gretzky's fast.
Gretzky smoked like the other dudes.
Super fast.
Yeah. It was surprisingly awesome.
Wait, does he also play tennis? Why do I feel like he probably does? I feel like there's weird hockey crossovers.
Right.
I don't know.
Korda. He didn't. Was the mom? No. I forget. Was she a golf or tennis too?
I don't know. Something.
Yeah.
It's like if you're an athlete, you're an athlete sometimes. Well, I hate to wrap this up because we could keep going. Actually, maybe like we'll finish this at the pub, as Chris would say.
Oh, and then I just had a funny little thing. I was thinking we're talking about form versus function when it comes to coaching tennis players.
Uh-oh.
How about if you were form versus function, if you were teaching someone how to string a racket?
Oh.
Now you got to have the beauty, are you a pusher or a puller?
Hey. Listen,
electric or manual.
You got to do it, right?
Well, there's that, right? But you also, when you're dealing with like, say, a natural fiber like gut.
Yeah. Or shape string.
Yeah, you got to go some of those shape strings too because you want to string them flat.
Yeah.
You know, like
Yeah.
And so in order to keep the tension neutral, you go, when you weave, you go left over right on one way and then right over left on the other way.
So he's getting into the his form now. He's getting serious.
That's actually another podcast.
I don't care how you look when you do it. You better be pinching that gut.
And I want you stepping in.
Yeah. It's all different now.
It's my way or no other way.
Right.
Oh, that's funny. Well, thanks you guys for hanging out and chatting about all the things and doing this.
Yeah.
Thank
we
you.
We would love if you guys could let us know what more you would like to hear us talk about. And we're going to do some more fun stuff and highlight more gear and more philosophies and more coaching and all the things. And that's it. So yeah,
let us know in the comments what's better, good tennis or pretty tennis? Or both.
Or both. Yeah.
Or none of the above.
Let us know. Let us know in the comments section. Yeah, yeah. And happy hitting. Go have fun, do your thing, and keep posting on Reddit. I'll be watching. Okay. Bye. Game, set, and match. Thanks for joining us on this episode. Lots of people don't even realize that Tennis Warehouse has a podcast. So if you enjoyed anything you heard in this one, we would be so grateful if you shared with your friends, coaches, or anyone else in your tennis world so we can keep growing our Talk Tennis community. How would you rate Talk Tennis? Did we serve up an ace-worthy episode, or did we double fault? Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. That's it. We're done. Now go get on the court, play with heart, and happy hitting.